Blog Talk Radio.
Michael Wiese Productions Filmmaker Dialogues. Your host is Michael Wiese Productions Vice President Ken Lee.
Hi, good afternoon everyone. This is Ken and I'm really pleased to welcome our guest today. He's Steve Kaplan, author of a new book coming up called The Hidden Tools of Comedy. Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Steve, We've first heard about Steve Kaplan and your comedy intensive workshops through the grapevine and a few emails over the years. I'd really like to start out by asking you about how you started in the business and how you created the intensive comedy workshops.
Well, I actually started back in New York City in theater. I was asked to start a theater company, and at the time, New York theater was very serious. I mean, it was a bunch of people who were all wearing black turtlenecks and taking themselves very seriously and doing plays with characters whose names were he or she or the pharmacist or the man with the big pain in his head. And I would sit in the back of the theater and kind of, in a snide way, make jokes about it. And so when my friend said, we want to start a theater company, I immediately said, let's differentiate ourselves from everybody else. Let's do a theater completely devoted to comedy. And so we started this theater called Manhattan Punchline, and a lot of great people came out of there. Michael Patrick King, who later went on to do Sex and the City, and now he's doing Two Broke Girls. Howard Korter, who's executive producer on Boardwalk Empire. Peter Tolan, a lot of great people and great actors like Mercedes Rule and Oliver Platt. And
wow.
When we started it, in the arrogance of youth, I thought I knew everything there was to know about comedy, everything. And then after doing it for a couple of years, I thought to myself, okay, maybe I don't know everything there is to know about comedy, but I know what's not funny, goddammit. But shortly after that, I thought to myself, how the heck does this stuff work? Why is something funny on a Thursday, but not funny on a Sunday? Why is a script sometimes the funniest the first time you read it, but then every time you go back to it, it gets less and less funny? What's going on? And at the time, a lot of the people around the theater were talking about what they called the physics of comedy. You do this, you do X, Y happens. You do Y, X happens. And so I started to experiment with actors. It's not really as horrible as it sounds. I was running an improv class at the time, and I started to try to design exercises and techniques and games to try to get at what is happening. What is the fulcrum, the tools, the levers that are controlling comedy? Because as a producer, I would stand in the back of the house, or I would stand off stage, and I would watch the show every night.
Right.
And the actors would come off stage, and they would say, boy, what a terrible audience. But I was watching the show from the audience's point of view, and I noticed that the audience wasn't different. The performers were doing something different. So if they were doing something slightly different on one night, they would get one reaction. And if it was changed the other night, it would get another reaction. And I started to try to figure out what was going on. So out of that, out of those experimentations and that improv class, we designed a 40-week master class that was called Approach to Comedy. And when the theater eventually went the way of most theaters, which is, it was not for profit, and I didn't realize they were going to be serious about the whole thing. When I came to Los Angeles, I thought I would try to continue to do it, but given the variety of things that people have available to them in Los Angeles, and given sometimes the shortened attention span, so we took the 40 weeks and we squeezed it into a weekend. And I started giving it to as weekend workshops to actors. And around about that time, Derek Christopher, who's a guy who's worked with a lot of great coaches and consultants, and he was working with Robert McKee at the time, and he came to me and he said, you know, I think you could do for comedy what Bob does for story. And I thought, really? Maybe, I guess. And so we worked together and we started offering this, and you know, after a few short years, it's been offered all around the world. We've gone to Singapore, Australia, Ireland. I just went to Sweden this past winter. I'm going to Edmonton in 2 weeks. And at first I thought, okay, this is something for people who you know, are new to the business or haven't really done a lot of work or maybe just done serious work. And so this will be all new stuff to them. But if somebody who's really a comedy expert came in, they'd go, oh, we know what this stuff is all about. But to my surprise, what happened is I would have writers and stand-ups and directors come in, and they either said to me, I didn't know you could teach this stuff, but I was proven wrong. Or they would say to me, I always knew there was something like that, but I never knew what it was, and I didn't know how it related to everything else, and you were able to kind of put it into an understandable system for me. So
you were able to articulate sort of this underlying rules or
principles,
or principles that stand the test of time.
Right, and what we talk about is we talk about the hidden tools of comedy, because you know everybody knows about things like juxtaposition and inappropriateness. But what we discovered in my work in New York was there were some, what I thought were some obvious, but turned out to be hidden tools that people were unaware of. And that's what the basis of the course became, the things that you don't know about comedy, the things that make people say, oh, you can't teach comedy, you have to be born funny, which is ridiculous. Because you're not born poetic, you're not born dramatic. You know, it's an art and a skill, and it can be learned like anything else.
And Steve, can you recap some of your screen credits for people who want to get familiar with your work and as a writer?
Well, you know, I'm worked as a consultant. I'm actually a director. Again, like I said, I come from a theater background, so. I've consulted on a lot of things, or consulted with writers. A lot of the writers that I've worked with early in their careers have gone on to great success in other areas. For instance, I worked with young Steve Scrovan, who later became the executive producer of Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh,
and
wow.
Mm-hmm. Again, Howard Korter and Peter Toland, who did the Larry Sanders Show. So I worked with a lot of those people, but from in the theater we call it a dramaturg, more from the point of view of an editor, the point of view of somebody who is outside the process helping people do the process.
I see.
Instance, one, I'm occasionally brought in to do workshops and consultant work with animation companies, because animators are by definition the actors and performers and writers and directors of the feature, even though somebody else has written the script. You know, when you're animating it, you're actually doing the work, and their background usually is computers or art. And so I came in, I was brought in, and I was tasked to give some workshops to story artists and animators. And one of the best compliments I ever got was after I worked at DreamWorks, and they were working on Kung Fu Panda at the time, and the directors of Kung Fu Panda came into one of the sessions, and we actually worked on a story reel. And later I was told by one of the editors, one of the assistant editors, that when the director of Kung Fu Panda was sitting in the editing room, he would always stop them and say, "Now, remember what Steve Kaplan said,"
right.
Which was not only very, very pleasing to hear, but then I wondered where my cut was. But, you know, you can't have everything.
So, yeah, I can see your role as sort of like the boxing coach to a professional out there who's.
I am the Burgess Meredith to many young Rockies.
Exactly. You know, you have the spit bucket, you have the towel, you have everything. You keep pushing them out into the ring to take it. And tell me a little bit about that, because the language of comedy is always interesting. And in terms of stand-ups and so forth, they always use terms like "I killed the audience," "I slayed them," "I wiped them out," and so forth.
Well, there's a lot of violence in comedy there, and comedy is a very, especially people who do it with no net, like a stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very almost masochistic art. You go out there, and if you do well, you immediately score, and there's that immediate gratification, much like taking drugs. But if you don't score, if you
right.
bomb, there's no escaping.
Right.
You know, you know, if you write a screenplay and somebody doesn't like it, you get a call from your agent, and they say, "Well, it wasn't for them." They pass.
Right.
But so you can, and you can make of that what you will, and you can decide, well, they didn't get it, they're, you know, they're stupid, whatever. But if you're a stand-up and you're in front of a crowd and you're doing jokes and you're dying, there's no escape. And it is, it's a very brutal awakening that every comic I have ever known in my life has gone through. Most stand-ups, their trajectory is they go up as an amateur and they kill for some reason. For some unexplainable reason, they have a great night, and
right.
then for the next 2 or 3 years, they bomb until
right.
they figure out how to do it right.
Right. And so your upcoming workshop at the Great American Pitch Fest in June, I know this is a new venue for you, tell me a little bit about what the big promise will be in terms of the benefits of going to your workshop, the title of your workshop, and the kind of people that you hope will sign up for it.
Well, I think we're going to get a lot of people who are either working on a comic feature pitch or maybe they have a pitch ready for the. The Great American Pitch Fest, or they're thinking about other pitches that they could have, because you, as I understand it, it's a great event. You come in and, you know, you're actually sitting with the real executives and agents and managers who are really going to make decisions, and you have a few minutes to pitch your ideas, and then if they like it, you know, relationships are formed, scripts are transferred, and perhaps careers are made. And what I'm doing is I'm doing a session called The Comic Premise. How do you create and then develop a comic idea, a comic premise that can not only be successful in terms of the 5-second pitch, but how can you create a comic premise that has the potential to be developed into a satisfactory and successful major motion picture?
And your workshop will be how long?
It's an hour and a half, because that's all you need. All you need is an hour and a half to teach somebody how to do comedy. any more than that, and I think you're just wasting people's time. No, it's a very intense, hour and a half. We go over the idea of the comic premise, or what we call the lie that tells the truth. How to create it? What elements need to be in there? And then we actually have people work in teams, and they create just for the class setting a comic premise. And then we're going to go around the room and talk about what works, what doesn't work, and why it doesn't work, and more importantly, what you can do, what tweaks you could do, what changes you could make to the premise to make it a more workable, viable narrative idea. And basically, I think that's what the course, the seminar, promises, that it not only teaches you or helps you understand better how comedy works, why it works, but more importantly, why it's not working. What's going on when it's not working, and most importantly, what can you do to fix it? What steps, what actions can you take that can actually fix a moment that's broken? And one of the things that we do is, like a lot of screen consultants and coaches, we look at some clips of successful movies. But what I always find equally helpful, even perhaps even more helpful, is we show clips from movies and TV shows that aren't working. And rather than just have the, well, it's just not funny, we go beyond it. We go underneath it. We figure out exactly what's going on. Why isn't it working? And what choices could they have made that would have made it work better?
You know, you bring up a really interesting point, Steve, about the visceral reaction of comedy, you know, because the standard civilian out there will instantly vote, you know, funny, not funny, within a heartbeat. While a dramatic pitch, say a log line for a dramatic movie about a bear and a boy and a journey, you know, people are sort of like willing to...
Ken, I love that. Can I option that?
Well, the bear happens to be Irish.
And did the bear have a mother that was kind of torn from him at early age?
Yeah.
I think we've got a hit here.
But what I was articulating was the idea that I would think that in the pitches and the log lines and in the communication of every single aspect of a comedy, there is this initial, immediate, visceral reaction, as in I get it or I don't get it, and that the stakes are actually so much higher than some of the other genres out there. There's no willingness to let something build and like, well, it could be funny, it has the potential to be funny, or it should be funny, as opposed to a log line about a dramatic vague story that people say, you know, it sounds, could be interesting, it could be developed, you know, I'm willing to go along for the ride. Is that your sense as well, that the genre has higher stakes and higher demands and higher criteria than anyone can possibly fathom?
Well, I agree that there's an obligation in a pitch to instantly communicate not only what the story is going to be, but how fun it's going to be, and if you can actually get somebody to giggle, to chortle,
yeah,
chuckle. At the pitch, then you're in good shape. I mean, there's a bigger problem in then translating that idea into 90 to 110 pages,
right,
that bring other problems. But I think what people worry about, and they worry about it unnecessarily, is they worry about being funny,
right.
And the first thing that I talk about in the workshops and in the book is that there is a big difference between what's funny and what's comic. Funny is your reaction to something else, and I can't control your reaction. In fact, the more I try to control your reaction, the more I'm annoying you.
Yeah.
Of a bad sitcom that's on TV that's desperately trying to make you laugh, and you're sitting back there, and you're going, oh, this is terrible. And the louder the studio audience is laughing, or whether it's the studio audience or whether it's some souped-up, enhanced version of the studio audience, the louder they laugh, the more you think, wait a second, it wasn't that funny, and it just alienates you more and more. The trick isn't to worry about funny. The trick is to worry about what is comic, what is human. and relatable and shareable in that moment. And let funny take care of itself, because funny is a subjective reaction. I mean, haven't you had the experience of going to a movie and you're sitting there and you start laughing and somebody next to you turns and says, "What are you laughing at? That's not funny."
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to hit yourself on the forehead. Oh, my God. I was so wrong. I shouldn't have laughed there. No, funny is a subjective reaction. But comedy is an artistic, aesthetic perception of the world. And like any other art form, it has rules and it can be learned. So that one of the things that we talk about is, don't worry about funny. People are funny. You're funny. I mean, just think of your relatives. Think of Christmas dinner or Thanksgiving dinner, and all the weird, annoying, lovable people sitting around that table. You don't have to make them funny. They are hysterical. You know,
right,
when your cousins get together and you talk about your aunts and your uncles and your mom and your dad, and you're all cracking each other up. You're not trying to make yourselves. You're not inventing things. You're recalling things. So part of the trick of comedy is simply tells the truth. People often have the idea that it's drama that tells this serious truth, and comedy is exaggeration and slapstick and what's not real. And I think it's exactly the opposite. Comedy tells the truth, and specifically, comedy tells the truth about people. It tells the truth about what it's like to try to live and survive and navigate in this crazy world we live in with no rules and no guidebook, and we just all do the best we can with all the flaws we have. And what differentiates comedy from drama is that in comedy, characters are unaware of how messed up they are and how hopeless it is, and they never give up. So
your workshop would be appropriate for multiple genres within the comedy spectrum, like romantic comedies
and broad comedies
and so forth.
Michael Haig and I actually went to Australia last year, or maybe it was the year before that, and we did a 2-week tour of Sydney and Melbourne with The Art of a Romantic Comedy, a two-handed seminar. He would do structure, and I would then do comedy the second day. So, yeah, I mean, it's not just one type of comedy. And the people who come to the workshop, they're writers, they're directors, they're producers, they're working in TV, they're working in features. I had an editor come and say, "Boy, this was really helpful in helping me cut the movie." So,
in terms of the international market, the Great American Pitch Fest does a wonderful job of marketing their events, and they get people coming from all over the world. But what if people drill down onto the website and they see your workshop and they say, "Well, this is an American sense of humor. This is American set of rules." How do you address those kind of questions and concerns from people?
Part of what we talk about is film, and I think film is an international language. Now the English language is not international, but I did this workshop in Singapore, I did it in Galway, Ireland, I did it in Edinburgh, Sweden. And those are all very different cultures, and they speak different languages, but they all get it. Because even though there might be some cultural differences, there's definitely big political differences, you know what's the same? The same is that there are mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and husbands and wives and girlfriends and boyfriends, and no matter what the milieu, what the external circumstances are, what's happening with those people is a human experience. And I mean, in my travels, I try to take a look at what the cinema of the local cultures have to offer. So I saw a great film from Singapore called I Know Stupid about a bunch of middle school kids who are all sweating over their parents' expectations and trying to get good grades and trying to get into the better school and the rich kid and the you know lower middle class kid. And I'm thinking to myself, how is this different from my experience? How is this different from America? And
right.
then in New Zealand, I met the guys and worked with the guys who did this great great movie. It's called Sione's Wedding. And I think it was released here in the States as Samoan Wedding. And it's about a group of adolescent, past adolescent Samoan men who always ruin everybody's wedding because they all get drunk and rowdy and they never have any dates because they're all grown-up boys. And in order to go to the next person's wedding, Sione's wedding, they have to all bring a date. And it's the same thing that we all go through. It's American Pie, but only with Samoans.
Okay. Well, larger food portions, too.
Larger food portions, but the comedy is the same, the humanity is the same, it's recognizable, it's accessible, and there isn't as much difference as you would think. I mean, rhythms are slightly different. Swedish comedies tend to be a little slower than American comedies are. But the language of film, the language of all performance comedy, is not that different. I would suppose that there's some Bunryoku Japanese comedy that would probably not play on Fox TV. But I think you have to really stretch far afield to find something that is completely inaccessible. Now what is true is that comedy that's verbal tends to not travel that well.
Right.
So if you have a very verbal comedy in Swedish, when it's translated into English, it tends not to have that big an audience. But again, there's the mindset that it won't travel, so nobody brings it over. But if you think about great comedies like the Swedish comedy My Life as a Dog, Amelie. I mean, if you give great comedies a chance, they will find an audience, and people will love them. I think The Artist is a great example of something that understands that if you can forget about the verbal aspect of comedy, then it doesn't matter if these guys are French or American. We get it. And we understand it and we appreciate it.
That was a bold experiment out of the blue.
Yeah, but I had a friend the other day saying, "I'm giving up the business if The Artist is nominated for an Academy Award." On the other hand, I saw The Artist in the same week I saw Hugo and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and all I can tell you is, I loved all three of them for all different reasons, but they were all magnificent films. They took me into different worlds. I laughed. I cried. They were complete experiences, and I think more and more we're finding that America is becoming much less parochial in terms of what it will accept in terms of what it thinks will be commercial and what it thinks will be successful. So you have a lot of foreign directors, more foreign directors now working in Hollywood, and I think that people are looking for ideas wherever good ideas are. Sometimes they translate well, like in The Office. Sometimes they don't translate well, like Australia's Kath and Kim. But I think if you've got a great idea and have the ability and talent to bring it to fruition, I think people anywhere, especially people in Los Angeles, are going to sit up and take notice.
In your workshop and in your book, Hidden Tools of Comedy, do you address the notion of the cyclical nature of comedy, or is that a myth? You know, for example, Bridesmaids, The Hangover, those kind of big, broad comedies that are more than PG, you know, bending towards the R side. They seem to be very hot right now. Is that a cyclical trend, or is it something that's new that's bubbling up? What's your thought about that?
Oh, well, I think there's always been gross out comedy. I think that before the Hays Code, you could get away with a lot of stuff that the Hays Code then kind of papered
right.
over. But you know, we've been seeing gross out comedy since the 60s and 70s. I think the big difference is actually the Judd Apatow comedies that before, you know, and the Farrellys got close to it a couple of times
there's something about Mary.
Mary and with the movie about the twins, the Siamese twins, which I kind of loved, that Farrellys figured out ways to combine raunchy, gross-out humor with real heart. Because before,
right.
you would have big...
One or the other.
Right, you would have either big slapstick or gross-out comedy, and then it would all be satirical, like, we're going to make a satirical point, you're going to learn something from this. And when the Farrellys started, and I think that the Apatow comedies really have perfected to a certain extent, is the fact that, you know, there's gross parts to life. There, you know, anybody who's ever had a baby is part of a living gross out comedy. So anybody who's ever had sex,
that should be the forward to the what to expect when you're expecting.
I think so. I mean, anybody who's ever had sex, badly or not badly, you know, is living part of a gross out comedy. But what they also realize is that we're people and we're all striving for something, we want something, and so they also realize that you have to have heart. The heart that goes into any romantic comedy needs to be part of every comedy. Which is why I prefer Bridesmaids over Hangover, because I thought Hangover was a brilliant concept. Brilliant.
Yeah.
A detective mystery married to a frat boy gross-out comedy.
Yeah.
But you notice that in Hangover 2, it doesn't hold together.
No,
because they try
to make it bigger and louder and grosser.
And once you get, it's going to be some kind of mystery that they stumbled into and we'll figure it out, there isn't a lot there. Whereas in Bridesmaids, there's so much heart and reality and relationship. The moment in which the girl that Wig plays freaks out because her best idea has been stolen,
right.
and she just loses it.
Right.
What's wonderful about that is that it's a little over the top, but we've all been there.
Right.
The only difference between Kristen Wiig and us is that we might have had enough social inhibitors to stop us.
Yeah.
And she doesn't. But we don't look at her and say, that's different than us. We never would have done that. We look at her and say, oh, my God, I know exactly what she's thinking. I know exactly what she's going through.
You just directly answered my question, whether you know it or not, about your ability to kind of create the historic through line of comedic films that work or don't work, and the progression of the Farrelly brothers to the Apatow films, and why a lead man, Seth Rogen, works now but probably wouldn't have worked 10 years ago. And I can see that, the often used criticism that when you dissect comedy or when you analyze comedy, you destroy it. That doesn't hold up at all. It's actually
I don't think so.
Interesting the other way around.
My experience is that when you look at it and try to understand it, you just love it all the more. I mean, I use a lot of Groundhog Day in my class, as an example of a great movie with a great premise, a wild, out there premise, but totally organically developed without ever telling another lie. One of the
precepts, the great Bill Murray film.
Right, it's the best Bill Murray performance, I would think. Where he's the lead. One of the precepts that I teach is the fact that you can have an outrageously unbelievable situation once in your screenplay. You can lie once. But after that, it's really incumbent upon you to develop the characters and the scenario organically and honestly from that big bang, from that initial lie. And after that, you have to ask yourself honestly, what would happen then? As opposed to thinking, well, it's a comedy, I can throw in more stuff, and I can do more gags, and I can have more unbelievable stuff happen. Because people have seen films like Airplane and Scary Movie and think, well, that's the way to do comedy, just throw gag after gag after gag. But what they don't realize is that the universe that they've created in Airplane encompasses that world.
Right, right.
It's a world in which the laws of physics don't hold, but you can't, for instance, in an animated movie like Chicken Little, which I've had the bad grace and temerity to actually teach as an example at Disney. They have this premise, this little anthropomorphic chicken tells everybody the sky is falling and he embarrasses his father, and how do you deal with that embarrassment in middle school?
Right.
Great premise. And then there's an alien invasion in the middle of the film.
Right.
Those are two different films. Those are two separate films. Two separate films, film ideas. They both could work well, just not together.
So in The Hidden Tools of Comedy, your book, which will be published by Michael Wiese Productions in 2013, and at the Great American Pitch Fest, it actually sounds like there are a series of almost algebraic equations in terms of things that work and things that don't work in comedy, and that they are.
I don't want to make it sound mathematical, but there are. There are things that it's more like cooking, you know.
Right.
There are things that if you don't have this ingredient,
right,
it might not work.
That's a very good analogy.
Put this ingredient in there, it's not going to taste too good.
Right.
So we have these hidden tools of comedy. Comedy allows your characters to win.
And like a good recipe too. That once you've hit your stride and you've experimented and so forth and you know some of the fundamentals, then you can go off and create your own little individual masterpieces. But if you don't have the foundation, you don't know that X goes with Y, you don't know that you have to have this ingredient and so forth, things just fall apart rapidly.
And I think the other thing that's valuable is that it's not a method. It's not like, okay, put your sausage, put your meat in here and just crank the grinder and sausage comes out.
Right.
It's basically my communication to writers, because I've worked with writers my whole life. I love writers. I love their vision. I love their idiosyncrasies. I love their imagination. And my whole talk to writers, my whole exhortation to writers is, trust yourself. Do it. Don't second-guess yourself. So the last thing I want writers to do is to say, wait a second, okay, what did Steve Kaplan say? No, if it's flowing, if it's wonderful, if it's working, just do it. But everybody knows you get to that part of the film where it's not flowing, you write the scene, you look at it, and it's not working, And that's when you use tools. You use tools when something's not working. You don't use a wrench to turn on your TV. You only use the wrench when you need to take the back off and see what's not working.
Steve, have you ever come across a case where someone might have inadvertently come into your workshop, signed up for the workshop, or came into another event with a very, let's documentary, a serious piece and so forth, and they pitched you and somehow through the magic of your humorous Aikido that you managed to convince them that they actually had a comedic property in their hands?
Well, I think that people come into the workshop looking to, some people come in looking to work on a comic idea they have. A lot of people come in saying, you know, I've never done, I've worked in dramatic genres before. I've never worked in comedy. I just want to find out about it. What I do have is people looking and saying, you know, I think I can do it. It's not as foreign and as mystifying and as mystical as I thought it was. It's not the big mystery where you either have it or you don't. It's just about telling a human story. And and if the human story has your main characters be flawed, and one of the biggest flaws and one of the most essential flaws is they should not know they're flawed. Just like we don't know that we're flawed. They should always be trying to accomplish their goals, defeat and depression, create dramatic moments. They should always be surprised, because the reality of the world is that we don't know what's going to happen in the next 3 seconds.
Right.
You know, we you know, for all I know, there's a meteor coming, hurtling through the sky, crashing into Chatsworth, and it's going to crash into my office and immolate me. I mean, that would be a shame. And I guess it won't happen. I hope it won't. But do I absolutely, positively know that it won't happen? No. So your main character needs to always not be sure. They're just not sure, because that's the way life is.
They're open to the universe, and obviously
oftentimes the universe confuses them. And if you have a character who's sure about something and absolutely sure, those are usually your comic characters. Those are usually your characters that are crazy, like a Kramer. Kramer's always sure about everything he does, right?
Right.
Because he's insane. So as long as you have somebody who's very much like you, or very much like somebody you know, you really know, in the center of your scenario. And if you create a scenario in which a normal person has to go through an abnormal situation, you're well on the way to creating comedy. And as long as you tell the truth.
Well, Steve, I think we're going to conclude this interview. Thank you very much. We're looking forward to seeing The Hidden Tools of Comedy, a new book published by Michael Wiese Productions in 2013.
Looking
forward to your workshop and making sure that a giant meteor doesn't hit Chatsworth any time in the next, say, 7 days.
I hope not.
Thanks for your time, Steve. I really appreciate it.
No problem. I had a great time. Thanks.
You've been listening to Filmmaker Dialogues, brought to you by Michael Wiese Productions, the world's leading publisher of books for independent filmmakers. We hope to see you at the Great American Pitch Fest, June 1 to 3rd. To learn more, please visit mwp.com, kaplancomedy.com, and pitchfest.com.